Hi, my name is Christopher, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Christopher.
And I'm from New York, Midtown Manhattan. My group is the PAX. We meet Tuesday. When do we meet? Monday and Thursdays. Monday, Tuesday, Thursdays. And I came in March 5th, 1996. So, I'm not one who likes to go through his history of drinking because, let's face it, we all drank. We all did different things. When I came in, a couple weeks before I came in, I was going out for Sunday brunch. And when a drunk says he's going out for Sunday brunch, he's going to get drunk. So I was going out, and I was on 81st Street in New York M, which is Midtown Manhattan. And I was walking up, and I was going up 79th Street. And all of a sudden, there was big winds or rains or something, so I want to get inside. I was still drunk the night before. So I go up the steps, and I'm in, and it's a Catholic church, and I'm a Catholic. So I sit down. I hadn't been to church in a long time. So I sit down. The priest starts his homily. Put down your scotch. Put down your bud. Put down your cocaine. Pick up the drink of life. Well, remember when you were still drunk the night before? Oh, my God, it scared the bejeebus out of me. So, after Mass, I went to brunch for a couple weeks. That was on my schedule. So, next thing happened was this guy that I knew, I went into this bar, and he looked at me and he said, Duff, I've never seen you that way. I think it's time you go to AA. Now, I'm from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. My father has 46 years in this program, so I knew what he was talking about. Because in 46 years ago, they used to have the meetings in our house in that part of Pennsylvania. So I said, excuse me, I got to use the restroom. So I go to the restroom, I sneak out the back, and I go three blocks over and two blocks up, and I go drinking. And then I said, oh my God, he's going to follow me. Like it's really going to happen. So I go out and I find another bar, and I'm just out for a couple more weeks. And then March 4th came, and I said, enough. I'm sick and tired of me being me. So I went to work. They were going to fire me in a couple weeks. And you guys know the gap. Knowing they have never fired anybody, well, I'm the one they fired. So I get up and I go to work and I call AA. And I say, I'm not saying I'm an alcoholic, I just think I need to get to a meeting. So they send me to a meeting, like on the 70s, I don't remember the name of the group. It was the first day I hadn't had a drink, and it's like 8 o'clock, and I'm like ready to tear anybody apart. And I go in, and there was a doorman or whatever he was, and he says, you know, they've canceled for tonight. I said, thank you. This is God telling me I'm not an alcoholic. So I go out to the street and I'm like, all right, Chris, just relax. And I said, I'm not even buying my bull. So I called Intergroup again. And that guy was so happy. He was jolly. He was like, oh, calm down, Chris. This is the best call you ever made. I'm like, shut up. Please tell me where the next meeting. Back in 96, we had phone booths. I don't know what everybody else had, but we had phone booths. So I go to find a working phone booth, and I call Intergroup again. And he tells me about this 79th Street workshop. So I said, all right, I'll go there. It's close. I'm 81st Street. So I walk over to 79th Street workshop, and I'm crossing over First Avenue. And I'm like, uh-oh. That's the church I heard the priest say what he said. Now, in my deepest, darkest drinking, I never lost faith in God. In my deepest, darkest days, I never lost Him in my life. He got me through everything. Footsteps is one of my favorite prayers that He has. So I said, okay, you don't have to hit me in the head with a brick, so I go in. So I go in, and I was, you know, dignified. I'm not here to stay in AA. I'm not here for what you guys are here for. I'm just here to figure out what's going on. So I go in, I sit down, and everybody's jolly, everybody's laughing, everybody's whatevers. And I'm like, okay, you guys are faking. You guys are lying. This is BS. So the meeting goes on. The guy was a roadie in the 60s, and he did this, and he did that, and he went this country and that country. I went from east side to west side. I went from downtown to uptown. So I'd never been anywhere. So I'm like, this is not me. This is not me. I'm not like my father. I never wanted to be like my father. The man can't stand my guts. Even in sobriety, he couldn't stand my guts. So at the end of the meeting, I didn't raise my hand and say I'm an alcoholic. I didn't say hello to anybody. I didn't do anything. At the end of the meeting, I go up to the chair and I say, and this is about the number of people that were in that meeting. So I go up to the chair and I say, I'm Chris and this is my first meeting. So the woman, you know how loud women can get? You're okay. So she turns to the crowd and she goes, everybody, this is Chris's first meeting. You all turned and came back. You weren't supposed to do that. You were supposed to go home and be with yourselves. But no, you came back. I put my head down and I barreled out of there. I'm one of nine children. I know how to get out of a crowd. So I went and white-knuckled it for the rest of that evening, like I'm doing now. So I'm white-knuckling it. Next morning, and I'll never understand this, who was at that 7 a.m. meeting at the 79th Street Workshop the next day? That was me. Didn't understand it. Don't want to understand it now. That's where I was supposed to be that day. So I'm coming back to the 10 o'clock meeting that night. I have 12 days left of work, and I go up to a guy who shared the night before, and I said, can I talk to you? He said, sure. My name's Joe. I said, all right, Joe, my name's Chris. What do you do here? Give me the rule book. Give me the instructions. Give me whatever. Don't talk to me. Don't call me. Don't do anything. Just tell me what to do. I'll do it, and I'll get on with my life. He says, do you want my number? I told you, I'm not going to call you. If I have any questions, I know where you are, you're here. I'll come here and I'll ask you the questions. All right. So he hands me the big book. I'm like, what's this? He says, that's the instructions you've got. All right. I go home. 2 days of sobriety, it didn't make sense to me. Not one word in that book made sense to me. And that's why it's a WE program. Because we're not supposed to read it alone. We're not supposed to do this alone. So I go back the next night and I say, I don't get this. He says, are you sleeping? No, I haven't slept in months. He says, well, most people fall asleep when they read this book. I didn't. I just got angry. Because it was talking about nothing. I know what I am. I know how I am. I know what I got to get through to get better. He says, okay, keep coming back. All right. So, the first year, I'm not proud of this, but I didn't get a sponsor, but I went to a meeting every day. Some days I went six times a day. The blessing in New York, you guys are everywhere. Every frickin' block, every frickin' corner, every borough. So I went. All you had to look back in 96 were cigarettes and styrofoam cups. You knew you were at a meeting. So I'd go in, I'd sit. I would not talk, I would not say anything. About 20 days, there was this meeting I went to. And I went to this meeting. It was somewhere in the 30s. It was an 8 o'clock meeting. And the door was locked. I was beginning to think you guys didn't want me. But this other guy shows up. He didn't have a key. So he goes, are you with a friend of Bill's? I said, I don't know whose friends I am. But I'm here for a frickin' AA meeting. You know I'm cleaning it up because we're being taped, right? I was not this level-headed back in those days. So anyway, so he says, do you know what it takes to have a meeting? I said, a room, chairs, a coffee pot. He said, no, two people. Two people is all it takes. So we had a meeting there. That's the first time I talked to one of you people. Trust me, I don't remember what I said. I just remembered I started talking and couldn't stop. And he just going, okay, okay. So I got the idea of what Sharon was about, and I started identifying myself in the rooms. After the first year, I got a sponsor. And that was the second blessing I ever got in this program. There was a guy who understood me 100%. He went through a lot of the things I went through. And he just took it easy with me. Anything I said, he goes, okay. I would say, no, okay, we need to do this. All right. Suggestion is, read Living Sober. That took me 7 months to read that frickin' book, and it's only 87 pages long. I'm not a stupid man. I'm intelligent. All right. So as you can tell, I was not an easy sponsee in the beginning. So when I did the steps the first time, all right, got to 4, and I went, okay, how do you make a lion son of a gun and have the nerve to tell him to be thorough, honest? I didn't know how to be honest. So I go to my sponsor. I don't know how to be honest. And he goes, you lie? I lie about everything. I lie about whether I go to meetings. I lie about who I talk to. I lie. That's me. He says, you're in the right place. All right. So help me stop. He said, you'll stop when you're ready. Okay, you got to stop that. You got to stop those stupid sayings every time I say something. He says, okay. That's one of them. All right. So a couple of weeks later, I'm like, all right, I'm going to stop. I'm going to start with my sponsor. When he asks me a question, I always have a response. It's not the truth. I'll say, no, it's not the truth. I'll tell him the truth. So it happened. He asked me a question. I tell him a lie. I go, wait a minute. That's not right. What do you mean? I didn't do that. This is what I did. Okay. And walks away. Every time I opened my mouth, I started admitting when I was wrong. Now, we went through the first 12. You're supposed to get it by you get to 12. No. I thought when I got through that 12, I'm ready. I'll live my life the way I'm supposed to. Just went to meetings once a day, every day. Called my sponsor every day. Did service every day. But I didn't change. I did not change. And this program is about change. This program is about not the way I want to do it. Because I got to tell you, I had the solution when I got here. I did. Do what I say. Do what I do. And you'll have a happy life too. And you laughed. Then, after we did the second set of 12, I got a little more honest with my sponsor. And third time, a little more. Fourth time, a little more. Fifth time, I'm the dumbest drunk you ever met. I really am. I'm a little slower than the rest of you. Fifth time, I'm like, all right, honesty. You got it. Anything you want to know. We got through those steps. He says, good. Now, is there anything else you want to tell me? And I go, I don't know. I said, I feel it, but I don't know. So he says, you will when you're ready. I says, okay, I will. 7 months later, I get a phone call. Here's something about my family. And it wasn't what I wanted to hear. My name was mentioned. It was happened to me. I didn't know what to do because my nightmares came true. All right? So I came running to the rooms. It was about 7 years now. I came running to the rooms, raised my hand, Chris, alcoholic. I'm so angry. Thank you for letting me share. All I did every day, because I was angry, but I wasn't about to talk about it. Wasn't even talking about it with my sponsor. I just couldn't talk about that. But my sponsor knew. He knew. He'd been through it too. God has a wonderful plan. He puts the people in our lives that are supposed to be in our lives to help us get to where we're supposed to be. I've been blessed never to go out. I've been blessed to come to these rooms no matter what I had to say, no matter what I had to do, no matter what. And you guys say, thank you for coming back today. Come back again tomorrow. And I do. Now, I got to 8 years in Queens, get off the thing, I go to change, I'm going back to Manhattan, and all of a sudden I say, I can't do this anymore, delete all the numbers off my phone that had A in it, all of them. There was too many, it took me too long. Standing right outside a bar, I said, I can go in there, nobody would know about it. I got all the names off, I said, all right, let me call Intergroup again. So I called Intergroup again. Is there any meetings at 31st Avenue or 30th Street in Queens? They said, there's a couple. So there were 8 meetings within a 10-block radius of my home. So I went to meetings in Queens. For some reason, that's where I started to change. The solution became clear to me. I started to let go of my solution and started picking up this program solution. And what the solution is for me these days, it's not the way I interpret the steps. It's not the way I interpret the traditions. It's not the way I interpret the concepts. It's how the program interprets it. It's how you people live it. It's not about talking about it. It's about living it. It's about living it. And you know what? After I found that out, then they tell me I have 3 months to live because I have lung cancer. I didn't have lung cancer, but they told me I had lung cancer. Blackest lungs the guy ever saw. He figured, you got a couple months, that's all you got. Black, not even a speck of light in there. It was pneumonia. I really don't have the smartest doctors in the world looking at me. Forgive me, docs, you're not my doctors. I'm telling you about the ones that I have. So they put me on the Bioxin because I have another allergy. So they put me on the Bioxin. I got cured of that. Then 3 years later, I lose my hearing. Went to meetings every day. Couldn't hear you. Went to meetings every day. My sponsor writes down, what are you getting from these meetings? I'm just not hearing the bull. I'm not hearing the bull. I'm seeing the sobriety. I'm seeing who shows up. I'm seeing who's helping the newcomer. I'm seeing who's talking to another alcoholic. That's all I need to see. So most of it came back. If you're behind me, I can't hear you. But most of it came back. I'm like 85, 90%. Okay. So I'm working, and I'm a waiter working for a company. I was at this corporate office. And just so you know, my last name's Duffy, so I'm Irish, 100%. And we use our face to break the fall. So I'm walking quickly down this hall. And I turn right to go to the elevator, and there's this glass wall. The glass wall did not have a nick on it, and it's still standing today. I have not had the same life ever since. For 4 years, they told me, and I don't have it, they told me that I'm in early stage of Alzheimer's. Now, you know, I went through 13 doctors who told me that. I get it. 13 doctors who told me that. And I came out of that last doctor's office, and I said, I'm in your hands, God. I'm in your hands, God. I'm not going back to see another medical person. I'm going to meetings. I'm doing service. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do. Last year, I finally get a doctor who says, Chris, you're epileptic. Chris, this is curable. Chris, we got medication for you. Now, the guy that was saying that, no lie, 7 months before, I'm training him and Intergroup to how to answer phones for AA. Am I covered or what? I'm covered. So not only is he in this program, but the specialist next guy I saw in the program and the head of the whatever she was the head of, she's in the program. Strike three, home run. So you know what? I am truly blessed. You are truly blessed. I did not want to come here after I said yes. But to me, this is the size of a New York meeting. So I was like, okay, I can do this. I can do this. And I'm looking around the room, and I'm seeing a lot of people that I know. And the last thing I want to say is, yes, the 164 is the program that we live by and everything. But if you go to 417 of the fourth tradition, you see the acceptance phrase. So the blessing of my sponsors is he takes me through the book. What I rely on is you being there for every time that I'm here. Thank you.
Thank you, Christopher. It was really wonderful to hear you. It's wonderful to be up here and see all these people with whom I do usually mix. And now I'd like to introduce my next speaker, which is Ernie M. from Georgia. He's a local boy. He's a first-timer, too.
Oh, this is nerve-wracking already. My name's Ernie, and I am an alcoholic. I'm used to, here in Georgia anyway, saying my last name, so I have to be careful because I don't want last names. But I'm not ashamed of it. There's a law named after my last name. And if any can go wrong, it will go wrong. So maybe you know what my last name is. But in any event, my sobriety date is January 18th, 1989. I had just gotten out of the military. I have a home group in Rankin, Georgia, about 20 miles from Savannah. We meet two nights a week. I have a sponsor, and he has a sponsor. I'm currently have the privilege of serving as the alternate delegate for the area of Georgia, or Area 16, which has been quite a rewarding experience. And it's part of my solution problem, or solution endeavors throughout my sobriety. The first time I got sober, I was in the military, and I was stationed at Walter Reed. I was a nurse on the terminal cancer wards, and I couldn't leave my patients. I'd carry them home with me, and I would get drunk when I got home, and it was my way of dealing with death and dying. Where I was working, we didn't get to see productive nursing care. We saw people come in, be diagnosed with cancer. We saw them go into remission through treatments. We saw them come back in to die. So it was, I rarely got to see any productive nursing care. And it took a toll on me because I was always brought up as a person that you did what you could do for everybody else. My family rented apartments to other people, and I saw my mother take a meal off our table to give to a tenant who didn't happen to have a meal, but their rent was paid. But she made sure everybody had food on their tables. So I was brought up that way, so I guess I came by drinking naturally. In the town I grew up in was a dry community. There was a liquor store, but there was no bars except the VFW. And it was a place I grew up, and I drank there. And I met a man the other day who's past delegate from the state of Massachusetts. And not only is that VFW still there, but they have step study meetings on Sunday morning. And they didn't when I was going there, and I didn't know a thing about Alcoholics Anonymous. But I had got into treatment when I was in the military, and got into it for the wrong reasons. I got into it to save my career. I got into it so everybody, one, would get off my back, but I knew that if I was in the drug and alcohol program, they couldn't, at that time anyway, they couldn't discharge me from the service and so forth. They couldn't penalize me for being an admitting alcoholic. And that stayed for a little while. I stayed sober for about 3 years. I had the opportunity to go and teach for the Army in Kuwait, and that was long before Black Hawk Down and all this stuff with President Bush. And I had started drinking again, and I took alcohol with me to Kuwait, buried in my suitcase, and the people in front of me that had gone ahead of me happened to have a bottle of Chevitz Regal, and they got picked up and put on the next plane out of the country. It's a dry country. And I'm going, we weren't supposed to have to go through customs, but nobody was there to greet us. So we had to go through customs. And he opened my suitcase, and I had a set of slides on the top of my suitcase. And he said, "You teacher?" I said, "Yes." He closed the suitcase, and me and my alcohol went straight through. So God working for me in different ways that I couldn't work for myself, and it's happened in so much. I ended up moving to my last duty station was in Savannah, Hunter Army Airfield. And I had a spell there where the commander asked me if I would take a blood alcohol test, and I said, sure. I said, I haven't been drinking. I had a few beers the night before. A few more than a few beers, but anyway. And I had some of the soldiers that worked for me that worked in the lab at Wynn Army Hospital at Fort Stewart. Anyway, he took a blood alcohol, and it went up to the lab for ETOH level, blood level. And one of my subordinates that I let go up there just cornered me later that afternoon. He said, "Don't worry about your blood alcohol." It came back zero content. I got a counseling statement over mouthwash. But another way that God worked his miracles. And I found, well, I retired from the military, and along in the middle of January, I went on a drinking binge, and I could not stop drinking. And I got a hotel room. The ATM machine was across the street. Next door to it was a fast food place, and there was a liquor store. And I drank myself into alcohol poisoning. And finally called somebody, and they took me to a hospital. I asked to go to a treatment center, and the one they sent me to was chartered by the sea. But in Savannah, we had no sea right there, but we had a big ditch, so it became chartered by the ditch. And the head of that facility saw me in the detox room, and he said, "Don't I know you?" And I looked at him, and I said, "Yes, sir." 10 years earlier, he had been the psychologist or psychiatrist in charge of the detox unit I had gone through in Bethesda, Maryland, while in the military. And he had told me then I wouldn't make it, but he was right. But today, thanks to this program, I got out of there. A man came to me in charter, and he was a volunteer for treatment facilities. And he came to me one day at lunch and was talking with me. And my roommate came in and said, "We got a session." And Leo said, "You tell your session leader that Ernie is with his sponsor." He found me. I didn't find him. And by the grace of God, I am truly grateful today. He was a retired command sergeant major from the military. And that's what I needed. I needed the regimentation. I needed to be told, "You will meet me at the clubhouse. You will go to noon meetings. You will go to X number of meetings. You will not speak until I let you speak." That's not the way today, but I'm sure glad it was there then. He even after we'd have noon meetings, he'd say, "That big meeting room hall needs to be mopped." I'd say, "Okay." I'd mop it. Took me 2 months to find out they had a cleaning service every night. But I was willing to go to any length to stay sober. And as far as I was concerned, Leo was my boss. We went through the steps, we worked the program, and I'm grateful to still be sober today. I was at a group meeting, group conscience meeting, and they asked me if I would stand for GSR, and I said, I had about 18 months in service, or in recovery. And I said, "I don't know. I have property in Florida. I may be leaving. I don't know what I want to do." And the one thing I can only stress to everybody is, as a gentleman told me, "Ernie, we're not asking you for tomorrow. We're asking you for today." Service work has kept me going. Service work has been my solution. Working with others has been my solution to this in this program. It gives me a chance to get out of me. I don't have a chance to sit on the pity pot. I don't have a chance to worry about what other people's problems are. I'm going to quote from page 25 in the big book, and I thoroughly enjoy it. But what it talks about there is we're approached by those whom the problem has been solved. They've admitted they were alcoholics. The problem's solved to them. But they need someone to guide them through the steps. They need someone to guide them through the traditions, to get them involved in service work with others. And we are guaranteed by the big book, as long as we're working with another alcoholic, we can stay sober today. They may not, but we will. And I encourage everybody in here, whatever your service position is, keep going at it. Do what you can. Get involved in your group. Empty the ashtrays for the groups that are still smoking. Clean the coffee cups afterwards, unless you got throwaway. We didn't when I got sober. Do what you can do to make your group better. Today we need more groups. Today I see a lot of people in the room. I see a lot of older people. All of you are younger than I am, but I see a lot of older people. And I'm beginning to see more new people as far as the younger generation go. If we don't instill in them what's been given so freely to us, it will not be given or be here for our grandchildren when they need it. Work with the newcomers. Support Gikipa or Ikipa. Support whatever the young people's groups are in your room, in your home area or your home group. Support them however you can because they are our future. But working with others kept me sober, and for that I say thank you.
Thanks so much, Ernie. Thanks, too, for reminding us about service and how much it brings to us. And I guess I want to thank all of you for your service and being here to listen and speak as well. Thank you. My last speaker is Clayton M. Clayton M. From British Columbia. And when I saw Clayton, I said, I know you, don't I? And he said, no. And that has happened to me a lot this weekend. I look out at your faces, and I swear 80% of you look familiar. And I know that can't be, but, you know, it's there must be something in our, or lack of something in our blood that gives us a real familiarity. So with that, I'd like to introduce Ernie from Clayton from British Columbia.
Thanks, Barb. It's great to be here. I'm Clayton. I'm an alcoholic. I made some notes just because I tend to stray, but I'll try not to follow them or not to stay too close to them. So, it's great. I'm from Surrey, British Columbia, just outside of Vancouver. I sobered up 19 years ago on February 10th, 1996. The topic is there is a solution. And chemically speaking, alcohol is a solution. But that's a different talk. In this talk, I'll do my best to tell you what it was like when alcohol was wreaking havoc on my life, what happened and what it's like now, how my life problems seemed so insurmountable when I was drinking that just before joining Alcoholics Anonymous, I was at the point of suicide. Then somehow, abruptly, my life changed, and AA abruptly changed the course of my life, and I was given a daily reprieve from a state of hopeless mind and body. I was the youngest of four boys growing up in a middle-class family in a small town in the interior of British Columbia. According to my family, I was a pain in the ass from the get-go. For me, I was just trying to hang on. On the outside, I was somewhat of an overachiever, good in school and sports, but full of anxiety, living with 100 forms of fear of rejection, fear of my functioning alcoholic father, fear of everyone else. Everyone else knew that what was going on except me, and that I was going to lose out. My first drunk was in the baseball diamond or the dugout at 15 in a total blackout. Even though I don't remember the night, I remember the day after, you know, and the squirrels had stopped in my mind, in my head, and I was at peace for a little bit, you know, and from that day on, I got drunk and high as often as I could. Even though I was drinking daily, I somehow made it to university, majored in psychology and political science. It was the 1970s, though, and there were a lot of drugs and music and free love. It was pretty neat, actually. Unfortunately, I couldn't see staying in school while the revolution was brewing, so I dropped out, and I was convinced the decision was a political one at the time, but looking back, it had a lot more to do with getting drunk and high than anything else. After a few years living as a hippie, I tried to get my act together and got a civil and structural engineering degree at a technology school. I thought this was my ticket to get a job working in the wilderness with the Water Survey of Canada and with the Canadian government. I have no idea how I pulled off getting a degree because the party was still on. I was convinced, however, that getting back to the land was the only way to live. But things changed quickly when I was offered the highest paying job out of my graduating class while working for a construction company in Vancouver. The hippie era was coming to an end anyway. I didn't know what happened to that revolution, and I was making really good money. And I had a few friends that were playing in the punk rock scene in the Pacific Northwest. And soon I was managing a punk rock nightclub called the Smiling Buddha Cafe and estimating million-dollar construction jobs during the week. And the Smiling Buddha was an excuse to party really hard, and I did. Not surprisingly, I lost the construction job after a while, plus a few more jobs after that. Eventually, my dad offered me a job working as an insurance adjuster back in my hometown. I took it, but not before asking an acquaintance if she would move there with me. And obviously, we didn't know each other that well because she agreed. And after a year or so, she got a little perturbed at my nightlife, and we started to drift apart. So we got married. Not long after, we were drifting further apart, so we had a kid. And to me, life was pretty good. I was my own boss. We had a nice house overlooking the lake, beautiful new son. I thought I was managing my drinking pretty good, but I do recall some friends saying they didn't want us to come for dinner anymore because I drank too much. And that was weird. I thought, what's up with them, right? It's not like I was drinking their booze. Anyway, I had some better friends to drink with. These were professionals that taught at the local college. We could drink all night in their hot tub and talk about all kinds of scholarly things. And I partied with this group almost every weekend, but my wife seldom joined. One night after I got home, one of the regulars, a history professor named Fred, somehow ended up walking down the street naked in a blackout into someone's basement and fell asleep on their couch. In the morning, the kids got up, probably to watch cartoons in the rumpus room, and found Fred splayed out on the couch. Not a pretty sight. The police were called, and they took him to the hospital and for a psychiatric evaluation. He spent a few weeks in the psych ward. No one realized how devastated Fred was from the event or that he was hoarding his sleeping pills, right, and until it was too late. So he overdosed, and they found him dead in the morning. We all attended the funeral and had a wake at the hot tub house, but drinking just continued like it always had, and the word alcoholism wasn't even on our radar. We were all professionals, after all. When my son was 3 years old, my wife finally had enough. She said, "You're an alcoholic, and we're leaving." And I told her, that's impossible. I own this house. I travel all around the province. How could I be alcoholic? We ended up at a drug and alcohol center where I vaguely recall being asked about 20 questions. I answered them as honestly as I thought they should be answered, and they said, "You're a heavy social drinker." And I said, "See?" And she said, "BS. And you're going to end up on Skid Row. And I don't want Adrian, her son, to be a part of that. We're out of here." I was dumbfounded. How could she just leave with my three-year-old boy? Skid Row? Ridiculous. Her demands to quit drinking were no more than a cruel attempt to spoil my fun just because she was so miserable. Drinking was the only fun I had, and she wanted to take it away. I never had an impaired charge or spent a night in jail except the one night when they busted the Smiling Buddha. But I'll never forget the day she left with Adrian. You know, I remember putting them in the car seat and shutting that door, and off they drove. And I had no idea what the problem was. You know, you walk back in that house and all the furniture's gone and it echoes, that empty echo. I don't know if you've ever been there, but, you know, I had no idea what the problem was. And quitting drinking, yeah, I wasn't considering. I ended up back in Vancouver, now running my own business. Fortunately or unfortunately, I met an untreated Al-Anon when I was close to hitting bottom, and she carried me for a few more years. Neither of us realized how sick we were, and crazy behaviors went into overdrive. Eventually, she said, "You're an alcoholic." And I said, "No, I'm not. I'll go for testing." Again, I did the same questions, and again, they said, "You're a heavy social drinker." So that relationship disintegrated. I ended up living in my office, unable to pay the rent, no one left to borrow from, and a very bleak-looking future. On the afternoon of February 10th, 1996, I walked up to the Yale Hotel, a blues bar where I drank daily to hear the music, of course, right? And sat wondering what I was going to do. Everything I had touched had turned to failure. I was physically, morally, and spiritually bankrupt. Yeah, all cards were at zero. Deep down in my core, what I really wanted to do was get a room upstairs in that hotel, and with the light bulb on a frayed string and a bed, as I imagined it, and just drink. That was what I really wanted to do. But I knew it would be my death. I knew, and my next thought was about my son, Adrian. I couldn't leave a legacy like that. How hard would that be for him? Same with my mother. She didn't raise me like that. I had to try something, and I concluded I really didn't want to die, but I had no idea what to do. Despite what everyone's telling me, I knew drinking was not my problem, but it wasn't helping. I would need all my wits about me if I was going to pull myself out of this one. So I put down my half-empty beer and walked out of the bar, and that was my last drink. A friend of mine had quit drinking, and I asked her how she did it and what she did when she wasn't drinking. She said, "You'd be surprised how often the question doesn't come up." You know, I trusted her because she drank like me, or she did it one time, but she wasn't going to meetings. After white knuckling it for a couple of weeks, I finally got to my first AA meeting, and I immediately felt an attraction. These guys didn't seem so bad. There was a few Mercedes in the parking lot, and there were women there. They had what I wanted, and it also got me back in the house with the Al-Anon for a few more years. I got a sponsor, started reading the book, and working my way through the steps right away. I thought that the only way I could legitimately drop out of AA was to do everything they said to do. That way, I'd be able to pinpoint exactly what was wrong with the program, and return to my preferred methods of enjoying life. The enjoyment that led me to dark places and certain death. I got step one of powerlessness in my first few meetings. I stumbled, however, when it came to believing in the higher power. I kind of glossed over step two with a vague acknowledgement of nature or universe as a higher power, but I really didn't see what role this played in my day-to-day life. Step three got sticky, though. It was hard for a staunch atheist to turn his will and his life over to a higher power. Someone at a step meeting pointed out that 85% of the people of the world have a belief in some sort of higher power. My first thought was, wow, that's a lot of stupid people. And aren't I lucky to be the top one in the top 15%? But then it occurred to me that although I relied on the premise that no one can prove the existence of God as a reason not to believe, similarly, no one can prove he doesn't exist. There was a 50-50 chance. And I'd gambled on worse odds than that all the time. I decided to do some more reading and found William James and Carl Jung not on the religious shelf in the bookstore, but in the philosophy section. That helped me get past the bias of my religious bias, and I began to read. Eventually, I took the plunge and voluntarily, without the necessity of a calamity or impending crisis, tried a prayer. It was amazing. I didn't die, didn't become stupid. I just became open to seeking an answer to this question of the higher power. And it felt good when I was in this mindset. I'm still seeking this knowledge of his will, and it feels better every day. My second stumble came as a result of not doing a thorough step nine. I'd made some easy amends to my family and friends, but I'd neglected the one person I hurt the most, and that was my ex-wife. One day she called up asking for money for our son's braces, and an argument broke out. She had a dental plan, and I didn't, and she wanted to split the entire cost of the braces, and I just wanted to split the part that wasn't covered by her plan. It seemed logical to me. And I tried to convince her. She said, how unfair it was, and she ended the conversation with saying, "I wish you were dead." You know, so I realized this isn't good. It's not going to go over well with my AA buddies, and I better do what. So I realized that I needed to make amends, and I sat down with paper, you know, and pen, and for the past 7 years, I had dismissed her entirely, right? Every chance I got, and I still resented that she had taken my boy away. But I learned a phrase in the meetings that one of our friends would say, "You could be right," you know, and that solved a lot of arguments for me. You know, yeah, you could be right, so I started my letter and I said, "Yeah, you know, you are right. you know, I am an alcoholic. You know, you were right to take Adrian out of the home and to raise him properly. You know, I put myself in her shoes and tried to acknowledge all the good things she'd done. She went back to school, became a respiratory technologist, gave me access when I didn't deserve it, and I wrote down as many things as I could and put in her mailbox, you know, because we weren't talking very much. And a few days later, we were back on the phone. Because I'm so smart, I was still trying to convince her how unfair her position was. She says, I didn't comprehend that she was actually paying for her dental plan, and I made no contribution. She again hung up saying, "You didn't mean a thing that you said in that letter." And at that moment, I realized that not only had she not ripped it up, but that it meant a great deal to her. It was important that I recognize the sacrifice she had made and acknowledge her hard work. She wasn't perfect, but neither was I, thanks to Step 4 and my sponsor for that insight. And we never got back together, but the braces got paid for, and my attitude changed to one of full support for her. We then worked together to raise Adrian as best we could, and he came to live with me and my new wife, Christine, is here with me today. And it was good for Adrian to have some guidance from his ex-punk rock father when he went through his gangster rap phase. I don't know how Christine put up with us, but we survived. And today, Adrian is a University of British Columbia graduate working as an environmental biologist for a construction company. So I'm amazing. I'm so glad I put down that beer in the Yale that day. God does have a plan. I'll close with this story about getting honest. Certainly, honesty is part of the solution we talk about. And getting honest helps rid myself of selfish, fear-based beliefs and attitudes. In particular, my attitudes towards money seems to be a litmus test of how I'm succeeding at this. When things are flush, I can be Mr. Big Spender and end up back at zero. When things are tight, I tense up and the anxiety can get so bad it seems like only a drink can relieve it. Maintaining a balance is a goal that seems to get easier the more I get sober, the more sober I get. In early sobriety, however, I was living alone in downtown Vancouver, having a great time. I was doing well financially, but I was still not out of the hole completely. I was going to meetings regularly, had a sponsor, was engaged in service. One day I was crossing a busy street and I literally tripped on a small package wrapped in plastic in a bank deposit bag and quickly picked it up and hustled up to my apartment and opened it up on the bed there, and it was $3,500 cash. And this thing, I'm like, thank you, God, you know, like, it's my lucky day, you know, this was going to be my reward for being such a good guy. I visualized a new set of skis, I'm from Canada, eh, and a season's pass at Whistler Mountain, wonderful. There was only one hitch. There was a deposit slip in the bag with the name of the Dick's Pub on it. That was a pub just up the street. Then the justifications began. It's not like I stole the money. I, like, just found it, right? Anyone in their right mind would keep the money. Dick's Pub would never be expected to be found and returned. And it's a pub, an evil pub selling alcohol to alcoholics. You know, I slept on it that night, literally. But the next morning, I thought I should call my sponsor and share the good news. I was ready for the discussion, though, because I suspected he may have different ideas. I even thought about cutting him in on the deal so he could share my good fortune. when I called, the reception was surprisingly abrupt. He wasn't willing to discuss my rationale for keeping the money. He just said, "Do you want to stay sober?" And I said, "Wait a minute, this isn't that serious. I have no intention of drinking. It isn't about that. This is just an abstract moral dilemma." You know, all you would say is, "Do you want to stay sober?" So I tried to tell him that I was aware of the moral philosophy debate. I had studied, you know, Kant, Devlin, Rousseau at university. All this evil money from pubs selling alcoholics. All he would say was, "Do you want to stay sober?" I said, "The pub probably has insurance to cover this money, so it's not really anyone's loss. Do you want to stay sober?" "Okay." So reluctantly, I packaged the money back up and made my way back up to the pub. It was in the afternoon, and they were busy stocking shelves for that night's activities. I asked for the manager, and eventually a stressed-out woman came out, and she asked, "What do you want?" And I said, "Did you lose something?" And she looked at me, and she looked back, and her eyes just lit up, and she just came running, gave me this great big hug. She says, "They thought I stole the money." So, you know, it felt, she gave me this big hug. It felt great. I don't know, this other staff thought I was an idiot, I think. But they, here she got this, so she had the full amount. She offered, the, you know, they offered me a reward, which I refused because that's the kind of guy I am. And I walked on out of there. The fire of gratitude that had been carefully nurtured from the embers of my early sobriety was raging within me. Life was fantastic. That experience kept me going through some difficult times, and I really think it really did keep me sober. When I was feeling down, I just remembered the relief and love expressed by that bar manager and how good it felt to have done the right thing. It felt good, and I had no need for a drink. Thank God for good sponsorship, because if it left to me at that stage of my sobriety, I would have failed. So life continues on. It's great to be at another World Conference with my wife of 13 years, and I look forward to be at Detroit next time, and you're all welcome to my hometown in Vancouver in 2025. It's going to be great. Thank you all.